Mini episode 251 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello and welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 251. I'm FDH managing partner Rick Morris, and I'm happy to introduce 15 key guest clips from our last 100 mini episodes. With the variety that is encompassed here, I'm confident that you will hear exactly why the motto "Nothing is off topic" fits this show like a glove.
In terms of the election, there's been a fair amount in the last couple of years of criticism from your side of the aisle towards the president on any number of issues, whether it be the fact that Gitmo is still open, whether it be some of the drone warfare that's been going on, the prosecution of whistleblowers, rendition, indefinite detention of U.S. citizens that was signed into law. So I'm curious, as a supporter of the president and someone who is a supporter of the president for liberal ideals, do any of these issues really trouble you that much, or are they just sort of like the cost of doing business? How do you look at some of these issues?
Well, I can't imagine the difficulty of being the president of the United States. It's such a daunting job, you know, I'm always surprised that we can't find more extraordinary people to come forward to be the leader of this great nation. You know, it seems, as I've gone through my life, that the pool of talent has gotten weaker and weaker with every passing generation. And I did hope that President Obama would be everything that he seemed to project. And he's failed at some things that I wish that he'd done a better job at. And but I can't imagine the difficulty of doing his job. Every president, every politician makes promises that aren't kept. I mean, I'm a sympathizer in the sense that I know that what President Obama inherited was an unbelievable mess, you know, and it's kind of like a house, our country, having, you know, that was burned down, and us people as a nation have had to go to work to rebuild what can't be rebuilt in 4 years. So I give the president a break for not being able to completely overhaul the country in 4 years' time. That said, and it's part of the reason why I made the film Jesus Was a Commie, was that one of the things that I think is damaging our country is this partisanship, that people not being able to reach across the aisle and do what's right for America and just holding the party line is something that is, to me, completely un-American. Our country's made up from people from all over the world, with different, you know, ethnic backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, and, you know, like the storm shows us that when your country's broken and torn apart by a storm or by a terrorist attack, what you have the opportunity to do is to put those things that separate us to the side and come together as human beings, as humanitarians, and work together to alleviate the suffering and the pain and the economic woes that people are suffering through.
In terms of the styles of music, in terms of some of the musical scenes of today versus when you first started doing the show, what are some of the big similarities and differences in your mind?
Well, I think the similarities are that people are always still looking for, you know, different things that aren't in the mainstream completely. You know,
okay.
I mean, there are artists that will cross over and artists that will start on a show like 120, like everybody imaginable did back then, from Nirvana to the Smashing Pumpkins, to Soundgarden. I mean, you know, And some of those bands started at, you know, some bands would start on Headbangers Ball. They were all over the place, but usually it was a launching place for a lot of artists. And then once they started to make it, some of them would stay in that genre. Some would get astronomically big. But what I still see is people looking for ways to discover music in different places. There's just a lot more choices than there were back then. I mean, I talk to people now, a lot of young people in bands, and they were like, you know, I used to videotape VHS. I'd tape the show and watch it on Monday morning or Monday night. Or I'd stay up and get in trouble for my parents. Or I'd just stay up and watch it at college. But, you know, there's a lot of options now. I mean, obviously with the internet, with social media, with streaming services, with podcasts, everything that's out there, it's a, you're a smaller piece of the overall pie. But, you know, I think the thing that makes it important for everyone is that because it is specialized, it is a specialized place, whether it's 120 or websites like Pitchfork, because it's a place to go and find new music, or if there's like a metal site or whatever genre of music you love, if you know it's a trusted site, it's about curation. It's about where you can go and hear things and trust the people that are telling you to check out certain artists. So it's important.
Albert Morris, 1,613 yards. Marshawn Lynch, 1,590 yards, five yards per carry. Give me your sense. Obviously, you know these teams very well. They're in the NFC. I think a lot of the success of RG3 and Russell Wilson has to do with the fact that they've had excellent running attacks and, as you know, makes the play-action pass much more dangerous.
It's too bad one of these teams has to lose, because when you look at what the Redskins have been able to do the last 7 weeks, I did their game against Carolina when they dropped a 3-6 with the loss, and Mike Shanahan came out after the game and said, you know, we're going to start evaluating for the future, and they haven't lost since. And, you know, you have to give RG3 a lot of credit. Kirk Cousins, who came in and won two of those games, one at the end against the Ravens and then beat the Browns the next week. And you mentioned Alfred Morris, you know, a sixth-round pick out of Florida Atlantic, played for Howard Schnellenberger, won one game last year as a senior. Everybody passes on him for five rounds. Redskins finally take him in the sixth round. And, you know, we know what Shanahan's been able to do with sixth-round running backs before. Just look at Terrell Davis. And Jim Haslett did a great job with the defense as the coordinator. So fun team to watch. You know, RG3 right from the start. We also worked his first game in New Orleans, and you could tell from the moment he walked into the room, you know, what an impressive young man he is. And same with Russell Wilson. Did their game week two against Dallas when no one really knew much about Wilson. He beat Matt Flynn out, you know, during the training camp. Flynn had been a big free agent signing from Green Bay. And, you know, you look at Seattle's defense with those big starters in the secondary, and you know, their defense kind of took charge in that Dallas game. Wilson's been tremendous, and you know, you look back to that Green Bay game, and that kind of gave them the impetus for their undefeated season at home. And it's been a great see West, and it was a division just 2 years ago where a 7-9 Seahawk team won the division and made the playoffs, and now, you know, with San Francisco and Seattle among the two best teams in the league. So again, this is a game that, you know, you hate to see one of the teams lose, because they've both been such great stories this year.
I do want to go off the grid from that a little bit, just because of something you put on Twitter this week and the story that I was able to see. And this was just fascinating to me and to anybody else who really is always wanting to understand the nuts and bolts of crime and how these things happen. We've been hearing all summer long about this huge summer of murder in Chicago. And your story ended up drawing some connections that I had never even imagined about direct cartel involvement in that and them being involved as direct players in this. So as far as structurally how this fits together, are we looking at a situation where the gangs on the ground are basically subsidiaries of them, or that it's any kind of a war in that way? I mean, that's fascinating, Armin.
You know, it's interesting, Rick. You know, in my journalism career, I think if I had to just pick one word that I go back to time and time again when I'm trying to figure out stories, is why. And like so many people, I saw the escalating violence in Chicago and the murders, and I just kept saying to myself, you know, why is this happening now? And I have some contacts in the DEA, so I called a friend of mine in Washington and I said, you know, I've read a couple things here, and there's been allusions to the drug gang violence in Chicago escalating. I said, is there a direct connection here? And he said, well, he goes, I can tell you that, but the guy you really want to talk to is this guy, Jack Riley, who's the agent in charge of the Chicago DEA office. And he's a very experienced. He's been on the front lines of the drug war for years. So I called Jack up, and I said, am I mistaken here? And for one of the few times, I have to tell you, I got the straightest answers I've ever received from somebody in Jack's kind of a position. He said, there's an absolute connection between the violence, the gang members, the cartels moving into Chicago, the fact that Chicago is in the middle of the country, it's a transportation hub, and it was fascinating. And then for Jack to allow us to come and really just shadow him around Chicago as he gave us a tour of some of the things that are happening there. I mean, you have, excuse me, you have three major cartels that are basically carving up Chicago and have been carving up Chicago for the last few years, most prominently the Sinaloa cartel with Chapo Guzman, who Jack Riley said is the most dangerous man on the face of the earth. And then you have the Zetas, which is the former military group in Mexico that is ultra-violent, and they're involved in the drug trade. And then you have another Gulf cartel that's there. And then you add in the fact that Chicago has the single largest collection of gangs in the country, more than 100,000 members. So they have the soldiers on the ground capable of moving and distributing the drugs. And then Chicago being such a huge transportation hub with trains, planes, freight, interstates, you name it, to move the product into Milwaukee, Indianapolis, Detroit, St. Louis, New York. And that's where these murders are the result of. And for Jack to be so blunt about it, I just thought it was fascinating and a really smart piece, which is the kind of stuff that, you know, I like to do.
I'd like to start this on kind of a light note. I'm unaware if this is anything that you know about or if this has really come to your attention or not, but from talking to a lot of the contributors to this program, most of whom are about my age or perhaps even a shade younger, and I would have been high school slash college age slash early adulthood when you were playing, I mentioned the name Mel Gray, and the first thing a lot of these guys think of is greatest return man in the history of Tecmo Ball. You know, I remember playing in my dorm and, you know, the video game, and boy, if you had Mel Gray, you were always a threat to return a punt for a touchdown. So is that something that you're aware of? And I got to imagine you're at least a little bit amused by that.
Yeah, well, you know, of course, you're making me seem real old, but yeah, I'm aware of that. My son tells me all the time that, you know, I don't play Tecmo Bowl, but he sort of let me know that I'm there and, you know, I have some type of presence there that I seem to make an impact in that game.
A name that we haven't mentioned yet, but is somebody also involved on the production side of this thing, a tremendous talent and somebody who I've heard say good things about you in interviews, Vince Vaughn being a part of this thing. And again, as has been emphasized in every interview I've read, somebody who's not just lending a name to the process, but very much involved in it also. So when you've got a talent like him as a part of this thing, what are some of the distinct elements that he brings to it?
Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley. Peter was the young man in Christmas
yes.
Story whose tongue gets frozen to the pie. They have their production company, and I literally got the job because Vince saw me in Lombardi, and they actually offered me a different part, the part that Brian Doyle Murray was playing. And, you know, I read it, and I said, when a dad of the Wonder Years says these lines, they will not be funny. They're just going to come across as really hard and prejudicial. And I really don't think I'm right. And my agent, even though the money was good and it was an offer, said, agreed with me, which surprised me because they're, you know, usually let's get it for the money. And he said, all right, we're going to pass. And then Vince called and asked why. And my agent told him, and he said, well, I respect that. And then 2 days later, he called back and said, you want to be the father, Sullivan of Sullivan and Son, at twice the money. And my agent said, I said yes before I even called you. So it worked out. And, you know, Vince, being an actor, I think was going more by seeing what I did on stage and as a performer than, oh, is he the right type or can he do this? He knew I could handle it. And it's actually been one of the easiest jobs I've ever had. I'm kind of the straight man in this, but it's been a lot of fun. And I'm really grateful for it. And I would do anything for Peter and Vince. They're just really good people. And they work hard. You know, people think, oh, he's the producer. He sits back and makes sure it gets sold. But they're there. They're at every shooting. They're contributing. They come up with some funny jokes. Let's shoot it again, but say this, and it'll be hysterical. You know, and Vince is always, you know, he's always looking, which helps me out a lot. He's always looking for that moment when we might be able to put in something touching as opposed mm-hmm. to just a joke. You know, when I went to Vince when we did the pilot and said, at the end, instead of walking off, I'd like to put up a chair. Vince went, that would be great. And Steve, you say to him, I thought you were leaving. And then Dan, say something back. And I said, force a habit. He said, great. And that was all Vince. So he sees that we need those moments in there to keep the bond between father and son alive. It is called Sullivan and Son. I don't need a lot of lines, but I need the key line to the son.
Are we not looking at something that is going to be, I mean, maybe not exactly unprecedented, but extraordinarily rare, whether it be Obama getting elected with an economy like this or Mitt Romney getting elected essentially purely in opposition to the other candidate there, as opposed to an affirmative choice that voters are making. I want this guy to be president. It's pretty clear at this point that if Romney wins, it's just going to be because there's enough Obama fatigue out there. It's been rare, if almost non-existent, for somebody to win when they trail in the likability as Mitt Romney does. So one way or another, are we not looking at something for which there's not a lot of precedent?
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And you can stack up those statistics. We can, believe me, I can make every one of these races sound historically unique and never before. Has, you know, I mean, last time around they told me a black guy couldn't get elected.
Well,
president.
Yeah.
You know, it turned out that wasn't right, you know. I mean, and you know, it really had never happened before.
Well, that's true.
Nobody ever came close, but, you know, there he is, right? So,
yeah.
You know, can a hedge fund zillionaire who won't show you his taxes be president? I don't know. I mean, they hadn't had too many before. I'll admit that.
You guys were bringing in some pretty big guys behind you at different points, as I understand it. One of our cast members here with the program is not only a fan of your group, but the world's biggest fan of Poco also. And he pointed out to me about Timothy V. Schmidt being a part of some of your greatest work in the early 80s.
Absolutely. Timothy is unbelievably talented. He did a tour with us while he was out of the Eagles. You know, the Poco had broken up, and he went with the Eagles, and then the Eagles broke up, and he was kind of on the loose just for a moment, and we were going out to do a tour, and he joined us for that tour, and oh my God, he's such a wonderful person, number one, but he's so talented.
And that was really a common denominator with that group, wasn't it? I mean, you talk about all the great session players that were involved as this thing came together, but it really seems like just one of those kind of magical meetings here, you know, when the group got together, because the talent level of everybody in the group was so renowned.
Yes, actually, David Page had just co-written the Silk Degrees album with Boss Gags. And mm-hmm. basically, you know, David Hungate, the original bass player with Toto, Jeff Porcaro and David Page were on the Silk Degrees album. And anyhow, after that album, they decided that Jeff and David were the headliners of Toto. They are the ones that decided to put the band together. They named the band. They did everything. And after the band was together, Jeff pretty much was the last word on every decision, and he was a very, very intelligent guy, and all of his decisions pretty much are the very thing that brought Toto to the level they went to.
It's a very interesting thing, Ross, in terms of the history of it, because, again, and you just mentioned the name and one of our past guests on the program, Greg Raleigh, and we talked to him when he was on. Now, we talked a little bit about his time with Santana as well as Journey, but that's
right.
Really something that you have in common with him as far as your tenure with the Steve Miller Band also, really. I mean, both of you being a part of two Hall of Fame caliber bands over the course of your career, not just one.
Yes, yes. And Greg had left Santana, and I'd left Miller, and Neil was right there at that point, too. So it was an introduction that was kind of interesting because the idea that was in mind, that Herbie had in mind, was to put these guys together and form a rhythm section, unlike Muscle Shoals rhythm section or something like that. A band of caliber players who would be available to work with any artist that came through. So that idea quickly, though, changed, and let's form our own band, which we did. And as a result, with Neil and Greg Raleigh and Ainsley Dunbar and with George Tickner, the other guitarist writer, we formed a band. And we're actually performing 2 or more years before we actually released our first album on CBS in 1975. We were actually playing in cities like Chicago, Detroit, and of course San Francisco, other places before we had an album. At that time, in that era, there was a phenomenon called supergroups, in which known players from various groups would get together and had the credibility and the availability as well to go out and play and record. So we were fortunate in that market and in that time period to go out and play even before we released an album. And of course, we did eventually sign with CBS and put out our first 3 records, 75, 76, and 77. They were entitled Journey, Looking at the Future, and Next, which brought us to a point in around 1978 in which the record company was wanting to hear and display a band that was more song-oriented. The first Journey was more experimental and odd-time signatures, and we there were vocally-oriented songs, but mostly instrumental and experimental, and the company wanted to hear a song. So that's when we began focusing more on the vocal songwriting end of it, and that was how Steve Perry came to the forefront.
What are some thoughts looking ahead to next year as far as some of the things to mark the 50-year history of the Pro Football Hall of Fame?
We have a whole 50-year celebration, which actually starts this enshrinement weekend, the first weekend of August, when we unveil our new logo for 50 years. Joe Horgan, the executive director, just showed me today this incredible book that will be coming out, the 50-year history of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, that he and John Thorne have written. It's a magnificent tabletop book that will be available. That comes out starting July 31st. We have, in the second week of August, a national fan vote. Their fans get to vote for their all-time favorite Hall of Famer. It's the fan favorite team vote by position. They'll get to vote for 8 weeks. The results will be revealed in a national TV special on NFL Network on February 2nd at 4 p.m. We have a 2-week window for the National Football League. The National Football League celebrating the 50 years of the Hall of Fame between December 2nd and 17th. You'll see Hall of Famers in their gold jackets speaking about the history of the game across all the different networks that broadcast NFL games. And we'll be honored by the commissioner with a round table. There'll be live on NFL Network with Hall of Famers talking about the history of the game. These are just some of the things that are going on throughout the whole year. We have a whole slew of activities at Super Bowl week. We have a traveling exhibit. How could I forget to mention that? That Joe has put together, Pro Football Through the Ages, that opens up in Pittsburgh at one of the Heinz Museums. It lives in every city for 3 months. They've booked it for the next year. I believe it goes on to New Orleans after that. An amazing amount of outreaches, and I've just named probably 4 of them and forgotten 5 of them.
What led you to that point of being able to be at a point to be able to advise people on fitness?
Well, to be honest with you, Fitness Made Simple, which is a line of DVDs and also a book published by McGraw-Hill, it's mm-hmm. a whole blueprint for reshaping your body, from okay. the nutrition plan to the workouts. I got started in fitness because of my own quest to be fit. I was shaped pretty much like a bowling pin on legs. I had a big, wide middle, long, skinny arms, long, skinny legs, no shoulders.
Okay.
I had started fitness when I was at a very down point in my life where I was in debt. I was obviously oddly shaped. I had lost direction in a bit of my life, and I was always a goal-oriented guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one of my goals was to appear in a fitness magazine.
Okay.
And a lot of people who get into fitness, the impetus is always physical in the beginning.
Okay.
But one thing I learned is that that's really just the tip of the iceberg, the physical benefits. When you really start living a fitness lifestyle, it pretty much has a ripple effect across all areas of your life, physically, mentally, and emotionally. But to start with, I started all these exercise programs that were media hyped, on TV, on the radio, on infomercials, you see in magazines and stuff like that. And I did them for about a year. I mean, everything from the no-carb diet to the no-fat diet to popping this pill or that potion to build muscle and lose fat. And nothing was getting me near the results worth the effort or the money I was putting into it. And I got to the point after a year where I just wanted to throw up my hands and quit.
Mm-hmm.
Say, listen, this is the body nature gave me. This is what I'm stuck with. This is what I have to deal with. And the one thing that stopped me was I hate wasting money and I hate wasting time. And I'd wasted so much time and money during that year in trying those other media hype plans, which really weren't that bad, I found out later on, but they were only one-dimensional.
Okay.
And what happened was when I sat down and I went, I also have somewhat of a background in biochemistry and biology, and I sort of sat down and said, rather than just listening to everybody else, try to find out something on my own, like filtering out what worked to some degree of what I tried that year, what didn't work at all, and what might work if I tweaked it.
Okay.
And that's when I had this big aha moment that there is no one direct technique or one direct path to get to fitness. You cannot just eat this or that and have the body you see on those models or the people in the magazines. You cannot just work out with this or that exercise gadget and have the body that you're seeing on those people. And there is nothing you can, one thing that you, or take this or that pill and get that body. Fitness is really a three-pronged approach, and what I created was the fitness triangle, and that's what Fitness Made Simple is based on. And just like the triangle is the ultimate structure in geometry, if you follow the fitness triangle, you will achieve your own ultimate structure, your own ultimate physique. And the three sides of the fitness triangle are time-conserving, lean muscle-building workouts, a fat-fighting nutritional meal plan, and then supplementation. Once you get that foundation in place, the workout and the nutrition sides of the fitness triangle, supplementation with products that will help further your gym and kitchen efforts and maximize your gym and kitchen efforts. And then within 8 weeks of tweaking and working on that program, which came to be Fitness Made Simple, I ended up developing the tight six-pack of abs you see on the commercials, the muscle definition you see on the commercials. It's not that I built that all in 8 weeks. A lot of people can have great muscular development who are walking on the street. But if they have a natural layer of body fat covering that muscle, imagine like a washboard covered by a pillow. The washboard's still rippled, the washboard's still hard, but you can't see anything because of the stuffing. What you have to do with your body is you have to reduce the pillow stuffing to just the pillow case to see that definition. And that's what Fitness Made Simple does. It helps you change your body composition. It helps you build muscle and lose fat. So if you're the skinny guy who's getting sand kicked in your face at the beach, you can build muscle, and you're also going to look hella ripped because those people, their muscles show when you're ectomorphic or rather thin. When you start building muscle, the muscles show more quickly. And if you're endomorphic or rather chunky, it helps decrease that body fat and build the muscle so that you can also reach that perfect physique for you.
I want to go back for a second. This is something I've said on the show previously. You mentioned Ronald Reagan. I'd like to test my theory against your experience, because you mentioned that about Ronald Reagan and the big spending of the 80s. And I know that, again, with the Democratic House, it always struck me that he was making a lot of these compromises with Tip O'Neill to get his defense spending there at the end of the Cold War. My sense is our opportunity that we had that was lost was when George H.W. Bush was president, because it seemed to me that would have been the time to get off the trajectory. We were going to be having the peace dividend in the Defense Department, and it would have seemed like you could have gotten off that Reagan trajectory for spending in the 80s. It never happened. It only kept going up. Am I right in thinking that that was our opportunity that was blown?
That's a very cogent, smart comment, and I accept that. But let me go back to Ronald Reagan for a minute, because, you know, it's the accounting stupid. I guess it was Carvel that said it was the economy stupid. I'm saying in my book, Unaccountable Congress, it doesn't add up. It's the accounting stupid. Ronald Reagan, yes, he was spending money on defense. He wanted to bankrupt Russia. But a lot of what he spent on, if we had a capital budget, would have been put as assets on the books. Unlike Jimmy Carter, who most of what he spent was governmental programs that were annual expenses. But you're right. On the one hand, Reagan was tagged as a big deficit spender, but if the accounting was right, he wouldn't have. But going to George H.W. Bush, you know, you made a very good point, because by that time we had bankrupted Russia, we built up the military, and at that point we could have done a lot to start saving for a rainy day. which we haven't done. But you can blame every president down the road, and the worst offender has been George W. Bush putting two wars off the books and spending like a drunken sailor when he was supposed to be a fiscal conservative. So, you know, we set it up so that when Obama came in, he could blame Bush, you know, for setting the trend for just spending in order to get us out of the mess. But it's a mess that, you know, we were put in not by any one president, but for many, many years, exacerbated under George W. Bush, and then, forget it, on steroids under Barack Obama, because in the last 4 years, the deficits haven't been less than $1 trillion. And in 1 year, it was $1,600,000,000. So that now we got not only a fiscal cliff, we got something else coming up, Rick. You know what it is? The debt ceiling, $16 trillion something. They're going to face it probably in January or February. And now we're going to see who's got the nerve to stand the ground and say, you know, I'd rather go bankrupt, theoretically, than keep kicking this can down the road. But that could be a problem because the rating services will come in, and then we'll see all kinds of other things play out. But you know what? At some point, we got to take a stand. And this country, the political system is broken. You can see in this last election, you know, I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, to me, it's a damn shame that it wasn't as competitive as it should have been. Obama, first of all, should never have been president to begin with. He was a community worker, a senator for 2 years, and because of the terrible experience we had under George W. Bush, he was at the right place at the right time. His rhetoric was perfect, hope and change, and he got to be president. But in my mind, he didn't deserve another 4 years. Look at the record. But was Romney the best candidate? No. I mean, for the message he had on health care, on Wall Street, on taxes, he was not the best candidate. They went after him with those super PACs, and I'm surprised he came as close as he did. But frankly, if he didn't have all those problems, he would have won in a landslide.
The last time that you were on, we were talking about this because you mentioned about tablets and using them as a sort of a bridging device here, sometimes with home entertainment and with shows coming from tablets to the TV. There was a development that we saw the other day that actually concerned a friend of ours, somebody that we've had on the show also a number of times, Jim Louderback from Revision 3, and with them being purchased now by Discovery Communications. And I'm starting to wonder, is it a thing that where you're seeing entertainment platforms with new media that are increasingly going to be incorporated with existing large media platforms? When you see something like that happening, it indicates that on the entertainment end of the industry also that you probably have a convergence that's coming. Are you kind of seeing the same thing?
Well, yes, and this speaks to a personal project that I've been working on, which is sort of digital entertainment in the home. You know, I have set up a complicated setup in the living room of my house that allows for all kinds of locally stored stuff, streaming stuff, TiVo, Apple TV, and it's marvelous. You know, but really only I can use it. So part of the thing is both to find a way to reduce the confusion of having 37. My Blu-ray disc player will stream Netflix movies. You know, So if somebody sits down in my living room, they have four different devices that they could turn to if they wanted to watch Netflix, and that's confusing. If somebody wants to just sit there and watch the news, it can be somewhat complicated. So I think we're in a situation where something has to happen whereby this stuff can go back to being, in some way, shape, or form, simple for you to just go access it from one point, and you can access it without having to worry about which of the many different sources you can pull from. This is going to be, I think we're going to end up with something that, some interface, and I'm sure that Apple thinks that they're going to find a way to do this, where you can go to a single thing and say, I want to see, the latest episode of, Falling Skies, and whether it is recorded on my TiVo, whether it's coming up in an hour on broadcast TV, whether it can be rented from iTunes or it's available on Hulu Plus, I shouldn't have to care. The system should just find it and maybe tell me what my options are about watching it now versus setting it up to be watched tomorrow, and just make it happen. And there should be a way this could all be sort of centralized and accessed without having to think about it being different. If people really want to say, I want to watch the Olympics, and I don't want to think about, you know, finding it amongst a thousand channels or finding some way to see, you know, some event that was in London 5 hours ago, you know, recorded somewhere in cache. They want to just basically ask for stuff and find it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're getting to the stage where the diversity and quantity of content is almost overwhelming to most people, and we need to come up with a way to have a better organizational and a better access front end on it.
I'm curious, in the case of Junior Seau, the thing I know for a lot of folks like myself who are formative years, you know, in into adulthood, were formed watching the guy seemingly forever on the football field. Just what a what a shock it was, and talking to my friends and people of my generation. I wonder what it was like out there in San Diego, the sense of shock. I know that, unfortunately, a lot of his teammates from that Super Bowl team are no longer with us, so... Are people starting to get at all numbed out there to this kind of thing, or did it kind of hit home even more because he's such an icon out there? And, you know, all communities, you know, we all have our icons. We can all picture the equivalent of, you know, thus and such passed away in our community. What was it like out there that week once it broke?
Oh, it was devastating. Everybody was devastated. It was, you know, even if you weren't a huge Chargers fan, you appreciated Junior Seau. I mean, there were kids. For 20 years, you know, the Junior Seau Foundation, little kids who have benefited from the impact that he's made every year, the Shop of the Jock, and, you know, going and, you know, all these children who, you know, have been grown up with them, and fans, people like me, who I'm a native San Diegan. I mean, I knew about Junior Seau before I became really a sports, you know, observer. And having known him personally, it was shocking. And, you know, this community, to see any of the images, you would know how we responded, because he was such, and not an icon who was up on a pedestal. This was a guy who would, when you're walking around, he would talk to people. He did not have that sense that he was not approachable. He was approachable, and he did things that interacted with fans and did such nice things that, in general, you know, people liked him. You know, I didn't know him. I wasn't on his inner circle, but I certainly knew a lot of people who were. And I knew him mostly from his, you know, from playing and from his charity work. But it was very sad. But I think what everyone, and I went to both the private services and the big one at Qualcomm Stadium, was let's look at this man's life. And the one thing that I thought was so important that we heard from LaDainian Tomlinson and others, but the example he set for young players and why they got involved in charity. Now, does that mean that he was perfect? No. No, of course not. But none of us is. But I think that is what we all embrace, that we knew that he would always, his legacy was, not only how he played and how he was the first guy, you know, who showed up in to work out, you know, on his 5 o'clock morning workouts, but and his incredible passion on the field, but how he did not let that be his only legacy. So, you know, the one thing that I took a little, I don't want to say exception to, but when they said, you know, he got out of the game and how was he going to deal with it? This is a man who had lots of things going for him. He was well known. He had lots of businesses. He was very involved. Now, what's the real story with some of those things? Maybe it wasn't as fulfilling, or we don't know. But we were very sad, but we really came together as a community to celebrate his life, which is not a trite thing. I think it's what people should do when they lose somebody who's very special and certainly in our minds too young.
I am struck by coming into this season, Mike. I saw that in two drafts that I participated in Labor Day weekend with my own two eyes. What a striking consensus that there seemed to be. There may not be a consensus on who's the top player, and that's almost invariably going to be a running back. There's three running backs in particular this year in whatever order, Rice, Foster, McCoy. You got Megatron in there, and then Rodgers and Brady. And that is something that, you know, I've seen all over the place, that there seems to be a consensus. You want to be in the top six. You want to get one of those guys. And the leagues that I was in, they can be a little bit unpredictable. And yet, both nights, though there was not a question that there was a big cliff after those six guys. There really seemed to be
the thought. What are your thoughts on that this year, and if it makes this year that much different than the last couple of years as far as where it's critical to be drafting in the first round?
Yeah, I think the big wild card to the whole equation in that first six, seven picks is how much you like or dislike Chris Johnson, how much you feel like you got burned by him last year. Because if you feel like he's back and in shape and ready to run, I think he becomes that de facto number four. But then going into the running back position from there, you start getting into, well, is there a vulture to steal goal line situations like Matt Forte has with Michael Bush? And then you've got a litany of guys with injury issues from Darren McFadden. Obviously, DeMarco Murray ran well last night. That 48-yarder will be on every highlight film for the rest of the season. And I'm sure you had a lot of, well, whoops or whatever at halftime or whatever they can do in terms of highlight shows. But, you just keep going on the list between Lynch's back issues and Richardson's knee and Adrian Peterson coming back. You know, there's just not a lot of running backs that you just say, you know what, I trust this guy fully. Ryan Matthews still in bubble wrap. With the quarterback position, I'm one that still thinks it's a little deeper perhaps than most, that in the end, if I don't charge out of the gate and get Rodgers or Brady, I have Brady 1 and Rodgers 1A, and then number 3, Drew Brees. I don't feel like I need to necessarily jump on board immediately, but you know, that was the trend this year, is that everybody had those 4 or 5 quarterbacks coming off the board with Stafford and Newton being 4 and 5 by the middle of the second round. And we'll see how it plays out, what that, you know, draft value proposition is when it's all said and done.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Paper Mate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and The Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.